if you're going to a Lutheran church, you should be hearing the name of Jesus more than the name of Martin Luther.
Pastor Trevor Sutton, author of the book Being Lutheran.
And I think that's really what Martin Luther would want. He made it quite clear that this faith is not to be based on him, but is to be based on Christ alone.
You can purchase Being Lutheran at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Being Lutheran, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
If you're going to a Lutheran church, you should be hearing the name of Jesus more than the name of Martin Luther.
Pastor Trevor Sutton, author of the book Being Lutheran.
And I think that's really what Martin Luther would want. He made it quite clear that this faith is not to be based on him, but is to be based on Christ alone.
You can purchase Being Lutheran at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Being Lutheran, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
Most of the time, there's not an effort to engage in your argument in any good faith. People will just paint you as a homophobe. So it really has just kind of narrowed and shriveled the bounds of discourse.
My grandmother used to say, don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out. There are some scholars who would really like something to be true who unfortunately become too open-minded, too uncritical.
If I'm looking inside myself for strength, it will fail. But that's not actually where my strength comes from, that Christ is greater than my heart.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
The influence of his theological thinking and writing stretches from his time in the 5th century through church councils all the way into the 16th century, finds itself in its way into the Lutheran confessions of the Lutheran Reformation, and continue to teach us today. On this 27th of June, the church will be remembering 5th century Archbishop Cyril of Alexandria. He wrote about the Trinity. He wrote about Christ, about the Incarnation, and we are still benefiting from his teaching. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, the 27th of June. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. James Buscher will be joining us. We'll be remembering 5th century Archbishop Cyril of Alexandria on his day today. A little bit later, we'll stay with the Church Fathers theme. On the 28th, the church will be remembering 2nd century Bishop of Lyon, Irenaeus. Dr. Joel Olowski will be with us to talk about him and remember him. Then, in hour two of Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, it's part two of our series on the liturgy of holy matrimony. Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be our guest. Dr. James Buscher is a regular guest. He joins us to talk about Cyril of Alexandria. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buscher, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Great to be with you today.
The Lutheran Confessions quote him, and not on small matters either. How do they make use of Cyril of Alexandria?
Yeah, you're right, certainly, to point that out, that the Lutheran Confessions probably quote him. I think maybe there's a little discrepancy, but he's right up there as one of the top two quoted church fathers that the Lutheran Confessions quote. Certainly Augustine is also right there at the top. But you're right to point out that Cyril of Alexandria was a significant testimony that the Lutherans looked to especially support their doctrine of the person of Christ in their controversies with the Reformed on the person of Jesus, especially as that Christology touched the Lord's Supper and the way Christ is present in the Lord's Supper. And so Cyril is very significant, I think, primarily because the Lutheran Reformers recognize that he has been, as you mentioned, since the 5th century, really onwards as the authority concerning Orthodox Christology. I think the Church very early recognized Cyril of Alexandria as maybe the touchstone of what it means to confess the person of Christ in an Orthodox way. And so he remained that throughout the church, and I think the Reformers certainly recognized that.
Tell us his story, if you would.
Yeah, Cyril is an interesting figure. He comes from a strong church background. He was born probably at the end of the 4th century, around in the 370, 380 area. And his uncle was becomes the bishop of Alexandria. Theophilus was his name. And so by the time he's even 7 or 8 years old, probably by 385 when Theophilus became bishop, Cyril is kind of handed over to Theophilus to conduct his education, his advancement, and his ecclesiastical career. So Cyril learns under the bishops from the time he's a young child, was educated thoroughly, not only in rhetoric, which would be usual, but certainly also extensively in the Bible. And he's probably a little bit unique in that he was had a strong education from Theophilus's under Theophilus's guidance on the church fathers. He's one of the first to start really taking note of what others had said before him, certainly others within the Alexandrian tradition, like Athanasius and others. And so he has a very strong upbringing in the church, is very theologically oriented, and then finally becomes kind of the right-hand man of Theophilus. And then when Theophilus dies in 412, he becomes the bishop of Alexandria. Even though the emperor kind of wanted somebody else, Cyril certainly enjoyed the support of the people. He becomes bishop in about 412, and really is bishop for 32 years. I think he's commemorated on June 27th because that's when he died, June 27th, 444. But certainly at the heart of his story is his controversy with Nestorius, who was the bishop of Constantinople at the time, and certainly revolved around the argument of how do you speak about Christ, and what does it mean when you say the Son of God became man? What does it mean that God became flesh? And that was really the central question that had to be answered. You know, throughout the 4th century, the Cappadocian fathers, Athanasius, had kind of figured out the grammar of the Trinity and the divinity of the Son of God. The divinity of Jesus had been answered, that question. And now the way was clear at the beginning of the 5th century to really now talk about, okay, if Jesus is indeed God, if he is indeed begotten of the Father, of one substance with the Father, what does it mean that God now became flesh and lived a human life, that he suffered, that he died, that he rose again? How do we speak of that? How do we articulate that reality? And so that central question was the primary question he had to deal with in his controversies with Nestorius, and then certainly kind of becomes his Cyril's confession becomes the confession of the church at the Council of Ephesus in 431.
Now, there are some subtleties here. I remember being taught in seminary that the Nestorian error was taking the two natures in Christ and teaching that they were united together like two planks of wood glued together, very closely associated, inseparable from one another, but still entirely distinct from one another in every way, kind of, to put it in technical terms, with no communication of attributes taking place one way or the other. What was Nestorius actually saying? What was his language that had Cyril's red flags flying?
Yeah, Nestorius is one of the representatives of the school of Antioch, and that is part of the issue that goes behind this, is Antioch versus Alexandria. Those two schools of thinking had come into clash throughout the 4th century and now certainly between Nestorius and Cyril. But what Nestorius, I think, what you have to say is most important to him was to maintain the integrity of the divine being, the divine nature, and to keep make sure that you never said that God, he didn't like the language that God suffered or that God changes. He knew when he thought about the incarnation, he was trying to think of how does the divine nature and the human natures come together. And as you say, when you start with the natures, the divine essence, the human essence, and you only think of the incarnation as the way those two natures now come together, he couldn't see any way they could really be changed into one another. That was what he was most worried about, that somehow when you interpreted John 1:14, that the Word became flesh, that he knew that that did not mean two things. It could not mean that God changed into humanity, and it also could not mean that the humanity changed into divinity. And so he was very concerned to keep the divine and human natures separate. Thus, you know, I think for Cyril, what was strange about that is it sounded like God never actually experiences a human life. It was more of a salvation by cooperation. That is to say, Nestorius kind of saw two acting subjects. We have the Son of God, who does divine works. You know, the Son of God forgives sins, the Son of God heals the sick, the Son of God raises the dead. But then there's this Son of Mary, this other acting principle, this other acting subject of the verbs, who does the human verbs. He's the one who gets sick, the one who tires, who hungers, finally who suffers and who dies. And so for Nestorius, he could only see that the Son of God and the Son of Mary simply kind of cooperate with one another in these activities. Thus, he has kind of a Christology in which you have two subjects of the verbs. He would read the Gospels as if you only almost have two actors. You have a divine Son of God and you have a human Son of Man. And for Cyril, that just could not be. I mean, if there's anything at the heart of Cyril's thinking, and this he gets from the Nicene Creed, is that you have one subject of all the verbs. And that is that the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, he is the subject of every divine verb and every human verb in the narrative of the gospel. So, yes, the Son of God forgives. Yes, the Son of God heals. The Son of God raises the dead. But the Son of God also is born of the Virgin. The Son of God is also suffers. He also hungers. He experiences the fullness of human life. And I think, you know, there's where kind of the argument and the battle is going to take place. For Cyril, this is how he read the Nicene Creed, right? The second article of the Nicene Creed makes the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, the subject of every verb, whether it's the fact that he was begotten of the Father or whether it is that he suffered, died, was buried, and rose. So every verb for Cyril must be performed and have its root in the divine Son of God. Otherwise, there's no salvation. And that's where I think it finally comes to Cyril. It is finally about whether you can trust the cross as an act of salvation. For Nestorius, the suffering of Jesus is more merely the suffering of this human man, Jesus. And for Cyril, that would empty the cross of its salvation.
Did Nestorius see the implications, as far as we can tell, of his error?
Yeah, no, he never. He will always, and I guess, you know, in fairness to Nestorius, I think you have to recognize that the grammar of Christology that we may take for granted, that he's one person and two natures that we get from Chalcedon, that really hasn't been established yet. And so there is a little fluidity here in the language. And Nestorius, I don't think he in any sense intends to say something false. I think for him, he would always reject what Cyril is implying or inferring from his words, that this is what he means in any sense. Nevertheless, his language is just too ambiguous, and he does it many times. He's going to reject, for instance, the language that Mary, for instance, is the mother of God. And when he talks about that, he's going to have difficulties. He's going to tend to now divide the narrative into these two acting subjects, and he'll kind of speak of the Son of Man doing some things, the Son of God doing other things, right? The Son of God is the one who feeds the 5,000. It's the Son of Man who gets hungry in the desert and those kinds of things. So when he starts to make these distinctions, which he, in his mind, are just distinctions, he has a real difficulty of really overcoming those distinctions and seeing any kind of unity in these things. So, yeah, Nestorius ends up being condemned and exiled, and to his dying day, he believes that he's teaching the truth and continues to kind of promote that Nestorian perspective, which, you know, I think remains even maybe to this day in Nestorian church.
Dr. James Buescher is our guest, Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. On this June 27th, we are remembering 5th century Archbishop Cyril of Alexandria. When we come back, we'll talk about that term, Mother of God or God-bearer, assigned to Mary, and we'll talk about his writings on the Trinity.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran Music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
The Faith, Once for All, Delivered to the Saints. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. James Buescher is our guest. We're remembering Cyril of Alexandria from the 5th century. Before the break, you mentioned that term, Mother of God, applied to Mary. That does take a little bit of explanation in our modern context, Dr. Buescher. So would you take us into how that came up, how Mary got dragged into this thing?
Yeah, it seems that, the kind of title for Mary of Mother of God or Theotokos or God-bearer, as you mentioned, was part of the piety, even the tradition, even in the liturgy of the church at Constantinople as well as Alexandria. You know, it has a certain historical use of the term by Athanasius and Gregory Nazianzus. And so it was part of a little bit of the liturgical language of the church, as well as not only that language, but also in that same vein was language about God's suffering, you know, the suffering of God, that God suffered on the cross. You would get language like that in the Bible itself, and certainly in hymns and in liturgy of the church. And Nestorius, that's where he had a little bit of a difficulty. His right-hand man, Anastasius, begins to preach and preaches that that's not what we should call Mary. Mary's not the mother of God. She's only the mother of man, the man Jesus. That's where really the origin of the controversy that will lead to the Council of Ephesus. And Nestorius, of course, as a bishop, had to answer this issue in his community because such a change from Mary as Mother of God was going to affect the liturgy, affect the very piety of the Christians in Constantinople, and so many resisted it. And the controversy comes to Nestorius, and he tries, of course, maybe like a good politician, he wanted to stay out of it, but he kind of got dragged into it. And he tried to sit the fence. He tried to say that Mary's not, it's not best to call her Mother of God nor Mother of Man, but Mother of Christ, Christotokos. And, of course, that didn't please anyone, as most kind of decisions like that do. But, of course, the problem ultimately for Nestorius in Theotokos, the reason he's resistant to it, and the Antiochene perspective was resistant to it, is because what they heard was they believed you were saying the divine nature is born from Mary. And that was utter nonsense as far as Nestorius was concerned. Mary is not the origin of the divine nature or the divine essence. And so that's what he thinks is being said by Mary as the mother of God, that somehow Mary is the mother of the divine essence or something. And so he rejected it. Of course, that's where Cyril gets involved. And for Cyril, the importance of this is crucial. For his perspective, he'll say, of course, Mary's not the mother of the divine nature. That's not what Theotokos means. But she is the mother of the Son of God, the person of the Son of God in the flesh. Right? In other words, the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, is indeed born in the flesh. So, no, she's not the mother of the divine essence, but she is the mother of the Son of God in the flesh, of the person of the Son of God in the flesh. And the reason for Cyril that was so crucial is it ends up for him being a baptismal question. And that is to say, for Cyril, if God cannot be born of woman, if God is not born of woman, then men, the sons of men, cannot be born of God. In other words, if Jesus, if the Son of God does not truly call Mary mother in a true sense, then we cannot really call God Father in a true sense. Those two truths are inherent in each other. That's what the incarnation means. Not a salvation by cooperation between God and man, but a salvation by incarnation. That is to say that the Son of God is born of woman, so that those who are born of women might be born of God and have God as their Father. And so it becomes, you know, for Cyril, a fundamentally baptismal question. And you can kind of see in that how liturgy, piety, Christology, sacramentology are all tied up together in Cyril's mind.
Is this connected to the other great subject which he addresses during his time, which is the doctrine of the Trinity?
Yes, certainly. I mean, all of these things are utterly, as you, you know, are interconnected in the most profound way, I think, for Cyril. And it kind of goes a little bit to, again, this notion of how he thinks of the Trinity. And we might even say how he thinks of the Trinity genealogically. That is to say that the origin of the Trinity, of course, the arche, the source of divinity is the Father. And the Father begets the Son. And then that begetting, you have a kind of eternal generation of being. The Father eternally generates the Son, so that there is a relationship, a communication between the Father and the Son that has no beginning and no end, right? Everything that the Father has, he communicates to the Son. That's kind of the notion of begetting. And that communication of life, of divine life, that communication of the Trinity that then subsists and dwells in the Spirit, that's really the communication that now takes place in the Incarnation. That's the communication that now happens between divinity and humanity in the person of Jesus, so that there is now an eternal communication between his divinity and humanity, so that we can say for Cyril that all the life of God, all of his divine attributes are now shared with the human, right? That the human is now part of that, so that even his flesh can be life-giving. His flesh can actually give life in the Lord's Supper. His blood can truly give life in the Lord's Supper. His voice, the human voice, can truly forgive sins. You know, all of that very intimate kind of communication is crucial to his doctrine of the Trinity, but also to his Christology, also to the way he thinks of the sacraments. And so, yeah, they are intimately kind of tied together. I think that, to me, is the overriding thing about Cyril. You can almost see Cyril's debate with Nestorius, that Nestorius is kind of an elitist. He thinks of salvation as coming from far away, from a top-down God doesn't really want to get involved with the vulgarness of human life. He remains kind of distinct and transcendent. But, you know, Cyril, what's interesting about him is he is, I think, throughout his life, you can see evidence of this, is kind of, you know, very populist. He believes in the immediacy of God with the human being. His notion of the incarnation is that God fully experiences a human life, and he's right there with humanity at every step of the way. He knows what it is to hunger. He knows what it is to thirst. He knows the vulgarities of life. He's experienced. He bears sin. He experiences the suffering, the death, the dirtiness of humanity. And I think that immediacy is really what drives him. There's where salvation is that God isn't just come to us in some kind of distant way. He's right there with us in the flesh. And that's salvation, that intimate kind of communion between a father and a son that is now present for us in baptism and in the life of the church.
Is he in many ways vindicated by this Council of Ephesus in 431? I mean, he lives to be contemporaneous with it. Is he a participant in it as well?
Yeah, he ends up leading the council in 431. Originally, it's kind of a strange council. Certainly, as you may know, all the councils have their political element, and this is certainly the case. Probably Cyril. You know, there's criticisms to be made by the way he runs the council. Nestorius and his bishops are there. Certainly, they were supposed to be there by June 7th, by Pentecost in 431. And everybody's there except the Antiochene bishops aren't there, and so they're delayed. But finally, Cyril takes control of the council, becomes head of the council, and there's a little ambiguity about how that happens. But on June 21st, the council actually begins in 431, and Cyril is the leader of that, and you know, certainly has the support of Rome as well. And in that council, Nestorius's Christology is rejected, and Cyril's Christology is accepted, and now becomes kind of the touchstone for what Orthodox Christology is. In fact, probably his full vindication of Cyril is at Chalcedon in 451, where the council, again, on another Christological question, will ultimately canonize certain of Cyril's writings, recognizing the orthodoxy of Cyril and that he is, in some sense, the maybe first and foremost authority of Orthodox Christology.
Dr. Buescher, we've got a few minutes left to us. I wonder if you have a favorite quote from this 5th century Archbishop Cyril of Alexandria.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult maybe to reduce it to one, but I, you know, do have one from his On the Unity of Christ, one of his most important writings against Nestorius. And it does highlight, he's talking in the context here just a little bit about the Eucharist. A lot of times we don't recognize the Lord's Supper was at the very heart of this controversy in which, you know, if Nestorius was right, we're in the Lord's Supper only partaking of the flesh and blood of a man, not God's own flesh and blood. And for Cyril, that meant that the Lord's Supper really couldn't give life at all. I mean, what good is it to simply partake of human flesh and blood if it's not God's own? And so here's just, in the context of that, a little statement about the Lord's Supper. He finally says, "There was no other way for the flesh to become life-giving, even though by its nature it was subject to the necessity of corruption, except that it now become the very flesh of the Word himself, who gives life to all things." And I think that, you know, basically sums up for Cyril, you know, that he's finally arguing about salvation. It's not just the technicalities of Christology or the high theology of Christology. It's finally about what's happening in the church and whether their salvation is happening there in the church, and whether we can trust that the very flesh and blood that we receive is indeed the flesh and blood of the Son of God, and therefore gives us life and salvation, as Luther puts it in the Catechism. So that's, I guess, would be one of them that would be always of interest to me.
Dr. James Buescher is Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buescher, thank you very much for being our guest.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Folks, a deaconess is a woman who is theologically trained and dedicated to sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ through acts of mercy and human care. You can find out more about the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. When we come back, we will stay with the early church back to the second century. The Bishop of Lyon, Irenaeus, remembered tomorrow by the church. Dr. Joel Olowski will be our guest. And then in hour two of Issues, Etc., part two of our series on the liturgy of holy matrimony with Pastor Will Whedon.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues, Etc.
What would you say if someone asked you to explain the Trinity? Would you begin with Scripture, the creeds, or some clever analogy? And how are Christ and the gospel at the center of this fundamental Christian teaching? Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Beckwith has written a new book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic series. It's titled The Holy Trinity. You can save $5 by pre-ordering The Holy Trinity at logia.org, L-O-G-I-A.org.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the clcc.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a Confessional Lutheran. The clcc.org.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues, Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues, Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues, Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues, Etc.